My friend, Ben Pratt, has a craft beer bar at 50th Street and 10th Avenue called As Is, where some of the best craft beer is available on tap all the time. My guest today, Ben Easter, runs something called the Breakthrough Bar, where he has enlightenment set up with the same handles and levers. Now, can he deliver the same quality of craft beer as my Ben? He does. A philosophical discussion on consciousness, money, building a life, values. It's all here. It's Open Loops. Oh, yes. Welcome to that late night talk show for the Shamelessly Fringe. I'm your host, Greg Bornstein, Chief Looper, Consciousness Disruptor, Cultural Hypnotist, Curator of Experience, whoever you want me to be. I'm there for you, champ. I'm there for you. Now, here's what's interesting. An open loop. What is it exactly? Well, I'll tell you in a second. You see, this is the show where my goal is to challenge you. Challenge your existing belief systems with radically unique ideas designed to stimulate your unconscious mind and force you to step into the highest version of yourself. We explore it all. Nothing's off limits, doesn't matter how taboo it is. Spirituality, esoteric topics, the metaphysical, the conspiratorial, the secretive, the magical, the hypnotic. Anything strange, anything unexplained, anything that will be extraterrestrial, paranormal, supernatural, mystical. Really, it's all about all. And it's all about you in discovering who and what you really are. Now, who is my guest today? Ben Easter. He's a lucid shifting coach. I'm going to call him a lucid shifter. I like that word, lucid. Everything he does has a little bit of a liquid quality to it. He created this thing called the Breakthrough Bar, Enlightenment on Tap, which is a community of people that get into these very playful discussions where he coaches you and just, boom, delivers a little bit of clarity, a little bit of confidence. He is really a open-hearted, kind, charismatic guy that what I loved was he took the challenge on, the challenge that I posed, which is I want somebody to change my view of the way reality works, my entire perception of how reality works in under an hour. And he didn't really say, these are almost my favorite types of people, because some people say, I can help you understand everything is quantum physics. I can help you learn about the law of attraction. He said, I'm just ready to, let's talk. Let's go. And I'm almost more intrigued by that. Sometimes that's the power of saying less, right? The good marketing gives you the hint. Also, lucid shifting. I mean, the branding was perfect. Yeah, here's a good marketing tip for all of you listening. Get the name of your product, your service, correct. And then once you have the name, then drop in a little bit of the invitations. That's the thing. If your name isn't right, then you need to do more outreach. It's something I've noticed. Just take that. That's my little bit of coaching, if you will. But that said, lucid, shifting, enlightenment on tap makes me think of craft beer. I loved all of it. Ben's energy was great. We went all around. I mean, talking about things that I suppose you could even say fall under that law of attraction thing, but not really, because what he zoned in on, it's something that I am personally zoning in on more and more, is the power of identifying your authentic values, the thing you want to create in your mind, and what is the distance between what's going on in your head and bringing that out of your head. And what lucid shift coaching is all about is shining a light on parts of your mind you weren't aware were there. He gets a lot more into it. It's a great discussion. If you like Open Loops, hey, make sure to share this podcast with people in your life that are close. First degree. You know what? I always say friends and family, but you know, on LinkedIn, it gives you those second and third degree connections. Share it with your third degree connection. If someone in your life right now needs a little bit of enlightenment, they just need to feel a little brighter during the day about any issue in their life. We cover it all in this episode. Wealth. We talk about personal purpose. We talk about relationships. We talk about all of it. Make sure to share this podcast, follow it on Apple Podcasts, and rate the show. You don't even need to leave a review. Just if you click in the show notes, there's a place to leave a rating. It really helps this content get out there. All right. Ready for some enlightenment at the top of your week? You're going to like this one. Here's Ben. Today on Open Loops, we have Ben Easter of Lucid Shift Coaching. He is a transformational coach, the leader behind the Breakthrough Bar, Enlightenment on Tap, which is all sorts of fascinating. We're gonna have a mind-bending conversation about the way life works. Perhaps we'll delve into getting past blocks, using language to construct your reality, the mindset behind money, as well as, and Ben was telling me before, how to believe in God, even though there isn't necessarily evidence that God exists, which is all, I mean, that's definitely a topic that fascinates me. We'll see where we land here. But Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Greg. I'm really excited to have this conversation. I love this kind of conversation, so.
Yeah, you know, you, I mean, based on reading your background a little bit and seeing that, you know, you came from, well, I mean, you were literally broken, right? You fractured and damaged your brain, and came through that. That is, I mean, do you think, I know it was one of the most painful moments of your life. Was that rock bottom for you?
It definitely was. I mean, it absolutely was, but it was the best experience of my life. You know, it's so funny because in reflecting on that, I think about that experience a lot because it's kind of how I got to where I am today.
Yeah. You know?
And you know, most people would say it's a horrible experience. And like, you know, if my mother were here, she would say that was the worst experience of her life. And having broken my brain in that way, like it really caused me to go through the process of intentionally redeveloping. Like, I'll tell you, I was an asshole in high school before that happened. That was early in college when that happened. And
yeah,
I was, I didn't talk to you about swearing. I don't know how that feels.
No, go ahead. It's fine with that.
All right, great. Great. So anyway, you know, I had a lot of like really negative social skills that I had developed by habit by hanging out with some people that were not really nice dudes in high school. And, I had this like pretty profound experience, you know, on drugs in the ocean. And it kind of changed the way that I looked at the world, but I wasn't able to actually catch up with my actions to how that worked until after my head injury. And from there on, you know, after the period of deep, dark depression and, you know, suicidal thoughts that I had, because I had lost the social skills that I had prior to that, that I had developed, that I'd naturally had. And so I had to go through, you know, first I had to kind of reconcile myself with that and then move into a world where I could practice myself back out of that. And because of that, that way wound up, because not necessarily because of the injury, but because of the recovery of the injury, that wound up being the most transformational experience of my life. Like, you know, I talk about these crucible moments that we have where you're kind of put, you know, the crucible is like the sort of alchemical tool that attempts to turn lead into gold. And that's like, that was the experience for me. I think we, a lot of us have these experiences in our lives where something goes horribly, horribly wrong, quote unquote. And then that allows us to have some sort of amazing transcendent experience afterwards. And that was mine.
Yeah. Well, what I find interesting is that I think some people do recover from stuff like this, and then they become these, they become therapists, or they become coaches or whatnot. But something about your background tells me it's a little more interesting than just I became a life coach, which and I think it's, I don't know. I mean, look, you've had, I know that you've studied under Tony Robbins and Rich Litvin, and you've studied Chinese medicine, but the name of your business is Lucid Shift, which to me immediately made me go, that is a very interesting word choice, a lucid shift. It's, I mean, most popularly associated with dreaming these days, big trend. Why the word lucid? How'd you land on that?
Yeah, that's great. I love talking about this because I think, so lucid means a couple different things. Like in the sense of dreams, we tend to think of lucid as being like clear, you know, you can see things clearly, but it also means light. It's a derivative of the word light, luce in Italian. So lucid shift means the shift that happens when you shine your light on something. So I have this kind of metaphorical way of talking about the experience of the universe. Like imagine you're in a dark attic. And you know, you don't know, it's like one of those old style attics, like a manor house attic, where it's like big, there's like walkways and all that stuff. And there's just stuff piled up everywhere, right? And you have just a mag light, like a torch, you know, and you can shine it, and you can shine it anywhere you want to in the attic. But you can only, because of the nature of kind of consciousness, the nature of your flashlight, you can only shine it at one place at a time. And so what happens is most of us wind up going through life and we're shining our flashlight wherever we're shining by habit. And because of that, there's a lot of stuff going on in the corners that we don't actually know. But if we were to shine our flashlight in those corners or in the areas where we're not consciously aware of them usually, and we shine our light on that, sometimes just the act of shining our light onto an area of our life, you don't need anything else to shift it. You don't need anything else to create transformation in your life than just looking at something. Now, sometimes it takes more work than that, but sometimes it's just the act of focusing on something. And in the presence of a powerful conversation, like even like one we're having right here, we can shine our light in a part of our attic that reveals something new to us about ourselves or about the world, and kind of changes our relationship to life, which is the most important relationship that we have.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I've always been amazed at the way, I mean, specifically with Tony Robbins, the way that, I mean, this is clearly the master. And as somebody that, you know, I'm always looking at Tony Robbins from the lens of, well, where he originally came from, which is neurolinguistic programming and hypnosis, and going, how does he cut through so quick? People like that. And, you know, Tony Robbins has never claimed to be, this is what I also love about him, he's never claimed to be an intuitive. He's never claimed to be a psychic. He's somehow able to look at people and very quickly get to the root of something, and something that often, especially when you see those intervention videos, the person doesn't even know it's going to go there. They have no idea it's going to go to this thing, but in under 5 minutes, he's able to speak to the pain in that person's life that they didn't even know was coming through unconsciously, shines the light on it, does the reframe or whatever he does to get the change, and then boom, that person's life has changed. You know, I don't want to expose your secrets, Ben, but I feel that is, at least at this point in your experience, do you feel like you're able to really shine a light where most people aren't looking?
Absolutely. And you know, and I was going to say, I love that you're so familiar with Tony Robbins, because you know, I don't think he's doing anything magic, although he does have a really strong personality. Like the man, I don't know if you've ever been in a room with him, but he is a force of nature, just like powerful beyond belief. Like, and he's so enthusiastic that you like get swept up in the current of his energy, you know? Yeah. And because of that, and because he's got the leverage of an entire room full of people putting pressure on someone. And I don't mean like pressure, you know, we sometimes think of pressure as a negative thing, but just because you have so many eyes on you, there's a lot of pressure to kind of show up as a way in a way that transforms. And so there, he's got leverage on his side when he's in front of a room of 500 people doing an intervention, you know? And so I think that's not to say that it can't happen in any situation, but it's to say that he's got lots going on for him. In addition to his expertise with language and his understanding of like the fundamental human patterns, he also had, there's like a kind of pressure, like you want to change if you're on the hot seat with Tony, you know? And so you like, you'll go with it. The thing that I always get curious about is like, how do those transitions or transformations last? You know, what's the longevity of those? Years later, decades later, because they are so powerful when they happen in the moment. I always wonder what happens, you know, later. Because in my experience, we can have the insight moment, which is really powerful. And then usually because our brains are, you know, wired through practice, we, if you only have the insight, you can feel really powerful in the moment, but then shift back into what you were doing before if you're not careful to maintain it and actually practice the new patterns or the new shifts in your mind. So I do get curious about that with Tony, but it's cool to watch him work, man. But yeah, so to answer your question, I don't think that it's all that complicated. Like humans are really, you know, we follow a set of similar patterns across the board. And yes, we're all unique and individual snowflakes, and that's great. However, you know, there's like a few things that really get in our ways. There's a few things that really tend to drive us motivationally. And, you know, when you look at reality, the reality is like, I have Mount Rainier out my window. So I always look at it when I think about the story, but you know, when you want something like to go, when you decide to go to Mount Rainier from my house, like all I have to do is pick that direction and start walking and I'll get there. Right. If I'm willing to meet any challenge that gets in the way and figure it out, like I'll get there. There's nothing really magic about it. You know, like I love in Kung Fu Panda, there's no secret ingredient in secret ingredient soup. That's kind of how I think about it. And if you're able to kind of hold that perspective that anybody is capable of anything that they want to, if only they can figure out every obstacle in the way, right? Then it becomes a little bit more simple to kind of find what those things are, because we can kind of go into the future where we've created those things, and then using our imaginations and the power of our creative mind, we can figure out what gets in the way of us being there right now. And then most of the time, those things aren't super complicated. They're just like deep and held on to, like we have to figure out the secondary reasons why we're holding on to these blocks, because usually they're keeping us safe from something or whatever. And so we've got to like make sure that the person feels safe and that they can make their own decisions from a place of really security in who they are. Like identity is a lot of times what we're up against. So
I was gonna say, I mean, do you think that, someone asked me this recently, I'm curious what your take on it is, why do you think most people are stuck?
I mean, it's a great question, and something that I think about an awful lot. And, you know, more often than not, it usually comes down to fear of something, you know? The biggest one seems to be, for humans, fear of rejection, fear of failure of some kind, you know, like I'm going to try something and then it's not going to work. And then that's going to be awful, you know?
Right.
And that's like, we have this, I call it the Disney syndrome. You know, Disney always tells the story where you like have happily ever after at the end of the story,
right?
Which, look, that's not how life works. Like you get married and then sometimes you have great times. Sometimes you have horrible times. You fight, you fuck, you whatever. Like it's life, right? It doesn't end when the movie is over. And so I think what a lot of people do is they tell themselves a story that something would go wrong and then that would be awfully ever after, you know, like, it'll just be horrible. We'll never recover. And it would just be awful ever after.
Right.
And because of that Disney story, I think a lot of people are prevented from taking the actions that would otherwise be the courageous thing to move them toward Mount Rainier or whatever their personal goal is. And you know, and then we just stay small. It's easier to play safe and to not risk our identity meaning, you know, and by that, I mean like not risk, because what a lot of us do is we take a failure and we make it mean something about ourselves. So rather than I failed at that thing, it's I'm a failure, right? And that's a different, it's a different lens. And once you do that, there's, that's a threatening place for us to be, because we don't want to feel like we're fundamentally flawed. And since a lot of us make this kind of a mistake in our thinking, then to take a risk and put ourselves somewhere where we're hoping or expecting to have a success and we might fail is just untenable. And so you see that most of the people that are most successful in life, they have figured this out, how to take risks, basically, and not take it personally when it doesn't work out. You know, Edison made how many light bulbs before he finally found one that worked?
Right, right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I'm very curious what, I know you do this thing called the Breakthrough Bar, which is every Friday, you do these sessions with people, where you do 5 spotlight coaching sessions to help people break through their thinking patterns. It's a very interesting idea. I guess, sometimes people go to actual bars and they attempt to do this with real bartenders. how did this idea come about?
It came about the first time because I was doing it on Clubhouse and I wanted to come up with something, you know, something catchy, the name, because really this is what I do with clients all the time is we sit and we have some kind of conversation and then, you know, I don't know a better way to describe it than some miracles happen. Like I wake up to texts almost every single day from my clients saying like, holy shit, something crazy just happened. And it was so cool. And thank you so much. And you know, I don't think that it's anything like magical about me. It really is. This is what we're talking about. The power of kind of picking where you're going and then being willing to do the courageous things to get there. But so when I'm thinking of a name, it's like, you know, we're going to hang out at a bar and having a deep conversation, you know, over beers or whatever. There's no beers. I don't drink beers at the Breakthrough Bar, but
right, it's like the right idea.
And then it's like, well, what could be on tap? And it really is just, you know, again, this lucid theme, enlightenment on tap is kind of the idea. So it's pretty cool. We show up, there's entrepreneurs, there's business owners, and, you know, we'll take a couple of people throughout the call and kind of work together. Everybody will hear what one person's going through and kind of see how it relates to their own lives as we kind of go through the conversation and draw in threads from everybody's challenges. Because again, everybody's their own unique snowflake. You get to see, you know, not only what the challenge of that individual person is, but how it relates to you and your own business. And then, you know, we get to solve that person's challenge, but also help other people maybe who are a little bit at different places in their journey to see around the corners and kind of protect themselves. What we do is we take people's stories and then we disassemble them. We disempower those stories. First, take the reality away from them, you know, because we're not talking about reality. We're talking about our perception of reality. And that's a subtle distinction, but it's a really important one because it gives us a lot of power. Once you realize that you don't actually have access to the real world, quote unquote, but just to your, you know, your sense data of it and then your interpretation of that sense data, right? All of a sudden you get some flexibility in the way that you can interpret that data.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. You know what? I want to know how you point people to that, because I think that's a thing we hear a lot. We hear people go, and I certainly know this from my early forays into life coaching years ago. Didn't really take off, or at least I was kind of doing it for a while just trying to do it. And I was like, you know what, I got to do something else. And then, moved on to other things, but I was very much, I was into the 3 principles, which is, I love that stuff. I mean, Jamie Smart, clarity.
Which one? I'm not familiar with the 3 principles.
It's this guy named Sidney Banks, who, I mean, it's kind of mindfulness-ish. And it's basically the idea that everything is thought. Everything is thought, all your feelings, you're just feeling, you're thinking. And once you have this understanding of the way the principles of thought, mind, and consciousness work, then hypothetically, once you have this understanding, anybody can coach themselves out of any issue. And so you just keep pointing people to the principles over and over. And it's really good. It was really good stuff. But what was interesting was that the amount of people I talked to, at least early on, and again, this is the beginning, as I was learning coaching, a lot of people would go, yeah, no, I know it's all a thought, but it still affects me. I still feel the pain. It still feels real. I'm curious, in your work, and even with Breakthrough Bar, How do you get people to really buy into the idea that their reality is different than their perception and not just know it intellectually?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And that is the work, is kind of doing that work over time. That's why like engagements last a minimum of 6 months, because again, you can have the insight, and insight is great. But even once you have the insight, if you don't practice it into your, I like to call the brain wetware, you know, it's like biology. I once saw neurons connecting under electron microscope. And it was so cool because you can see them kind of reaching toward each other. And then in the blink of an eye, they're connected. Right. And it's just such a cool understanding, like a cool way of seeing, literally visually.
And actually seeing your work under a microscope. I mean, that's so cool.
Yeah, because then not only are those two neurons connected, but so too do they, like they drag along their entire neural networks, right? And you make like an entire new network out of that. So it's really cool. But you can see that it's trying to do it for a long time before it actually happens. And anybody who's developed kind of a physical skill has seen this happen, like, you know, learning the guitar and trying to figure out your chords. And it's like really slow at first to figure it out. And then ultimately you can just snap to a chord. You don't even have to think about it, right? And we do this with driving, and we do this with talking is one of my favorite examples, because you see the mistake process in talking. You know, children, they try to say things and they don't get it out right. And then adults are like, what are you trying to say? And then they ask them again, and then they'll, oh, you mean bottle. Yeah. You know, like, and then the kid can like kind of try to practice that. So you can see like the stumbling process as it goes. And that's really what's happening in our brains. Anytime we make a change, it's not enough to just get it. And this is why people are like, yeah, no, I understand intellectually, it's all in my mind, but like, I still feel pain around it. And it's like, yeah, that's because you have to not just understand intellectually the new stories, but you have to kind of practice those stories over and over again. I'm a big fan. I know you mentioned that you've had people on that talk about manifestation. I'm a big fan of affirmations, but not from a woo-woo perspective. Like, I don't really believe that there, I like to find the meaning that is not magical, right? In all these things. And in the power for me of affirmations is kind of threefold. You're telling affirmations because, well, A, you've been telling affirmations your whole life, and what you see around you is a result of the affirmations that you've been delivering to yourself. All I mean by an affirmation is a thought that you think again and again, and you believe it because you think of it that way, right? So our beliefs are not things that happen to us. They're choices that we make over time because of the data that we see in the world. And it's a belief is like our best version of an interpretation of the data at any given moment, right? And so like, you know, there's this thing called the pyramid of beliefs. I don't know that it makes sense to go too deep into it.
No, wait, what is that? That's interesting.
So the pyramid of beliefs is, imagine, you know, a pyramid, and the ground is reality, but the pyramid is actually everything that's inside our consciousness. Okay. So the first layer of the pyramid is our sense data. And, you know, my sense data is different than your sense data, which is very different than, say, a bat's sense data, right? There's experience that's happening in the world that we don't actually have access to, only because we're limited to our senses. Like, I only have my five senses. Some people don't even have their five senses, you know, or there are like sort of other senses, like intuitions, things like that happen.
But
senses are, you know, everything that happens above is going to be limited by what we can take in through our senses, right? And then we're going to, above our senses are going to be our desires. So we're looking for, we have like these needs that we want in the world, right? So I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, whatever. And so then because of that, I'm going to have these hypotheses that happen in the world about where I'm going to be able to meet my needs for things. And so like, I go to the grocery store, and that's where I get an orange, right? And that's a hypothesis that I have, right? And then if I go to the grocery store and get an orange enough times, then I'm going to have a judgment about it, right? I'm going to believe that, or the judgment is the story that I go to the grocery store and I actually get the orange, right? So if that happens enough times, and I like say, you know, my hypothesis, get the orange, leads to my judgment. Yes, I got the orange. And you do that enough times, and then all of a sudden you'll have a belief that oranges are at the grocery store, right? But then if you're telling the story about, say, like toilet paper during COVID, right? You actually could go to the grocery store and not have toilet paper at the grocery store, because that was just what happened, right? And so this belief would be wrong, and we'd show up in the world. But what's interesting is, once we make these interpretations about the world and we get to the level of belief about something, now it starts to almost be this this circuit that we've completed. So now that we have a belief about something, we'll start to see the beliefs in out in the world. And this is called confirmation bias. It's a well-documented scientific phenomenon. It's basically a mistake that our brain makes, which says, like, because I believe something, I'm going to look for data to support that belief out in the world, right? And it's how we get into these loops. It's how we get into these echo chambers on Facebook. And it's how we, like, all of that kind of thing happens, is because we have this belief that then goes to interpret reality, right?
Yes.
It's useful for us to do this because there's so much data in reality that we can't actually possibly process all of the data in reality. And so we have beliefs that kind of do shorthand for us. They, like, help us to, you know, carry the one, so to speak, without having to, like, go through the process yes. of really dealing with, because I'm just, like, looking around my office right now and I'm seeing, you know, like, a bottle. But actually what my brain is seeing is, like, a hard thing that is purple, that is, like, shiny, and, you know, like, yes. all this stuff. And meanwhile, it's moving and I can't even see that it's moving because I'm too busy seeing a bottle. Even knowing that this thing is moving, I can't see it, because I'm too busy believing that there's a bottle in front of me, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Totally.
So this is where we have these kind of, these sort of mistakes that happen in that, because everything's not as easy and as easy to point to as a bottle, right? When we're talking about a concept like love or money or, you know, belonging, right? It's not even, it's hard, it's so subtle, like what's actually happening in our mind when we're talking about those concepts, that we could create errors around them, right? And even have any idea that those errors are happening, because they just always happen to play out, because once we have belief, you know, we just see the evidence of it. Like, for instance, I love this one, you know, a seven-year-old telling a seven-year-old don't talk to strangers is actually really good advice for a seven-year-old, right?
Yeah.
Not because every time you talk to a stranger, it's going to result in something cataclysmic, but the risk is high enough, and the sort of mitigating circumstances of when you want to talk to a stranger is complicated enough to explain, that it makes sense to just make a rule for a seven-year-old that says, hey, don't talk to strangers. You'll be safer. Okay. Just trust me. Right. But for a 36-year-old business owner, if I am running that program, don't talk to strangers, it's actually really shitty advice, because my business won't go anywhere if I'm not going and talking to strangers.
Right.
Really bad advice. And so you have this thing that was useful to get me to where I am now, but now that I'm here, it's not going to get me to where I want to go unless I kind of reinterpret it and come up with a different definition of how the world works, namely, strangers are actually really fun, and you never know if somebody's going to be your friend until you've met them. And, you know, you might find all these different beliefs, these different stories about the world, right? And really, that's what I think coaching is we're trying to understand what are the stories that you're holding on to right now, and then what are the impacts of telling those stories to yourself, so that we can kind of disempower them, right? And then reinstall new stories. And this is like the power of affirmation, or something like really like practicing an intentional thought, the power of visualization, things like that. They're just tools that we can use to reshape the matter of our brain into new patterns.
yeah. No, and I think what I picked up from you that was very interesting was this idea that you said it's not magic. It's simpler. Human beings are simpler. It's almost as if a coach is really, really just listening to people in a different way, which makes me wonder. I mean, what happens if you do breakthrough sessions with everybody and all of us start listening to each other in this way? Do you think, is there a certain point where this kind of self-development stuff, could everybody eventually be really in charge of their minds in a much more aware way? Is that a world we want to live in? I mean, I don't want to put you out of work, Ben, but I guess I wonder, what if everybody could really see each other if it just came down to a different kind of listening that you're just pointing people towards?
Yeah, you know, and I think that, I mean, look, it's not magic, nor is accounting magic, nor is marketing magic, you know. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to do it, because everybody's not going to want to do accounting. Everybody's not going to want to do marketing, right? Like, what I'm doing isn't special. I'm good at it because I've practiced at it a lot. And I, like, you know, I go to work and I read and I like listen and I engage and I think about things and then I practice a lot. But there's nothing like magic about what I'm doing. And I believe, you know, anybody could do it in the way that I believe anybody could do accounting, you know, in that, you know, probably not. Honestly, there's going to be probably some natural tendencies or more right. like desires to even ever want to do that kind of practice. But, you know, most people won't. So you're not going to put me out of work, in my opinion, just because everybody's in the same way that you're not going to put a marketer out of work or an accountant out of work.
That's a good point.
Everybody's not going to want to do those things. Yeah.
Yeah. Some people are going to want to just actually go and see somebody to, I mean, yeah, you hear it. I never understood even back in the day, I always thought coaching was kind of you need coaching if you're not doing it well already. And I think that comes from being in theater. And I remember my mom saying to me back when I was in high school, oh, you got to go see a vocal coach. You got to go see, you got to go see someone for singing. And that always put this idea.
Well, Greg, it worked.
Well, thank you. Well, I didn't. Well, I never actually saw someone for singing, but in a way, I mean, I did go to college for acting. Yeah. So that is why I definitely think it did help. And I appreciate that. And it's true. The exercises did help. But I think there is room. I think people are in a place. I've paid for coaching before. People like having somebody that can guide them. I think it's a very human experience. Do you find, I mean, since you've been in this a while, have you found that the type of people you're talking to, are there trends? Have things changed over time? Are people more open to this kind of thing than before? Or, I mean, it could have stayed the same. I'm kind of curious about what you've experienced out there in the field.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I will say, I do believe that not only is the field growing in the sense that a lot more people are drawn to coaching in the first place, but the field is growing in the sense that a lot more people are open to coaching as well. And so I do think that it's growing in that way and more people are open to the idea of seeing someone professionally to help them make some changes in their lives. In my own experience and my practice, the trends that I've seen, you know, so I started in dating and relationship in that niche because, you know, when I had my head injury and then I redeveloped my social skills, it was really with a strong emphasis on self-confidence, social dynamics, understanding how to like meet strangers and talk to them in such a way. I was lonely. Like I was mostly, I wanted to date somebody. I wanted to have a girlfriend. And that was like what really drove me through all that time. So then when I became a coach originally, it was because I was helping a friend of mine who is a coach and I was asking him these questions about his relationship and the dynamics that were going on. And he had this like big insight moment and then kind of like turned and with a curious look on his face, asked me if I had ever thought about coaching. And so when I first got into coaching, it was in that area. I was all about like dating and relationships and helping people to navigate their either meeting people for the first time or like developing rapport and relationship or, you know, kind of managing relationships that were sort of on the rocks, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Didn't ultimately love it. Like, this is one of my beliefs about business is that we tend to follow breadcrumbs. It sounds like you had a similar experience. Like you're like, this is okay, but I'm going to try something different with the coaching, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I knew that I loved the helping people and I was an acupuncturist at the time. And I was drawn to that because I knew I wanted to help people heal. I just didn't really understand which part of them I really wanted to help. It was always the brain. Oh, it was always the mind, you know, the thinking. And so I had a couple of clients who came to me for the dating and relationship stuff, you know, a marriage on the rocks and like trouble finding dates. And, but we very quickly kind of got them through over the hump for that stuff. And they were both of them with the remaining time in their contracts. They wanted to work on their businesses because they happened to be business owners. And I just loved it. At this point, this was my sixth business. And I've always been really drawn to the entrepreneurial lifestyle and doing that sort of thing. So when I went into this business, I knew that I just wanted to help people who were in business because it's just like, that's the kind of thinking that I love doing. It's kind of like this, it's like combining strategy with all of the mindset stuff, with like an understanding of confidence, with an understanding of social dynamics and how people think and psychology and all that stuff. All the things that I love, I get to do in my own work. And I will say that getting this business started and really coming to understand who gets the most out of it, it's like people who have already decided that they are like doers, that they're gonna like make something happen in their life, whether or not you know, they ever work with me or whatever, like that they're like actually committed, right, to doing something. Because there are a lot of people who are like, I would like to, and they're playing this game with themselves where they're like trying to dip a toe or trying to have the world prove to them that they're like the kind of person who can do it, which yeah. it's just not a game that really works. Right. It's always going to prove to you that you can't, if that's what you're looking for. That's, you know, another quote for you. Henry Ford says, whether you believe you can or whether you believe you can't, you're right. That's kind of the idea. But yeah, so the people that tend to not just work with me, but get the most out of it, they seem to be really committed to making something happen in their lives. They tend to be self-identified action takers. And then, you know, usually they are, usually they are dealing with some kind of fear. And I'm talking about even people who are like highly successful according to society's standards, right? Have trouble dealing with things like imposter syndrome, where they feel like, you know, they kind of got there by accident and everybody's going to find out soon if, you know, yeah. the other shoe is going to drop. Or they, you know, they really know. Here's one that happens a lot too, is they've been doing a thing because they were really good at it. Actually, they've always wanted to do something else, but they've just like never been able to believe that they could do that thing for a living or for their job or whatever. And so they're going to do this thing where it's like safe and people are asking them to do it. And, you know, like coming over that resistance hump of coming to believe that you can actually and see it, you know, because it has to happen in your mind before it can happen out in the world. You have to like believe that it's possible. Otherwise, you'll never take action on it, because your brain is there to do two things: keep you alive and use as little energy as is possible to do that. And
yeah,
because of that, you know, it's going to fall into these confirmation bias and attention bias and all these different things, shortcuts that it takes to, you know, lovingly help us to navigate the world. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
That is interesting. Now you're taking me on a different path here, which is the this idea of the brain being lazy when it comes to even, I never really thought about it in terms of the brain's relationship to visioning your ideal life, that act of, I mean, use the word manifestation again, but yes, that act of visualizing, that act of projecting your brain in a way that's different than what it's used to, totally forget that that's something that's uncomfortable for people, that it's not just, yeah, because I it really is. You do. That's why you see a hypnotherapist or a coach. These people are really great at pointing you and pushing you to go, no, do not keep doing that lazy thing. It's like exercise. Your brain is conditioned to do the pattern, in this idea that you're guiding people to, I mean, shine the light outward towards a future. That's the lucid using the light. But also, I think in a way, well, here's my question for you. Do you think you're shining a light in their mind to a part that they've always wanted to do? Or is it shining their light to what their heart wants them to do? And what do you think the difference is?
Interesting question. I think it's shining a light on, I think of it as shining a light on what they want first and foremost, but then shining a light on the invisible structures that are holding them back. So that's why there's like two different kinds of shining a light, because yeah. like, you know, one of my favorite sayings or metaphors lately is that you can't see the label from inside the jar.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
And this
right.
is, and this is why we can coach ourselves, but we'll never be able to coach ourselves as well as someone else could coach us. Because you don't know what you don't know. You don't know what you're unwilling to look at. Like the way that fear works for most people is the eye kind of slides off the thing that we're afraid of, because we don't even like to believe that we're afraid of something. That again goes to the identity meaning piece. So like,
yes, yes.
So, you know, like, and think about the classic procrastination pattern. So if somebody has something maybe that they really want to do, it's really important to them. They don't know how to do it. And they worry that they might not get it right or do it well or like be able to achieve the thing, right? And so they sit down to go to do the thing. And then before they know it, they're checking their Facebook feed or they're checking Instagram for the 27th time, right? They're checking email yet again. And it's because that's how the mind works. It doesn't want to look at this thing that's uncomfortable. It wants to slide over to this thing that's familiar and that's easy and that we know the clear steps to success, right? And yeah. so what we're doing is, we're identifying that thing that's so important, and we're really building it up. We're getting not just like intellectually understanding it, but we're actually like imagining what does the world look like? Really, how do you show up? What do your relationships look like? Like, how are when this thing is already a foregone conclusion, you're already there in your world. What does that mean? Like, how does it look in your life? How are you showing up? How are you? Where are you working? Where are you living? You know, where, like, actually imagining the world. And what that does is it activates this psychological effect of priming. So as we move through the world, we have opportunities and options everywhere, right? And the more that we prime ourselves to imagine the world that we want to live in, the more likely we are to notice when those opportunities present themselves so that we can take advantage of them in the moment, right? Because opportunities are going by all the time that we're not taking advantage of, because we don't always see them and we don't know that they're there in front of us. We don't always recognize them. So spending the time like in affirmation or in visualization and actually like practicing the mindset of the kind of success that you want to see in the world, whatever that is for you, by doing that work and by practicing those things and by making those neural connections, then when you show up and you see an opportunity, you're like, oh, this is that opportunity that I've been waiting for in my life. Right. And it's easier to, and you've already imagined yourself taking advantage of it. You've already imagined what kind of person you would be if you took advantage of that opportunity. So, you know, you've practiced a little bit in your mind. And just like you can, I can practice my scales on the guitar in my mind, you know, and actually get better at it. There's really like a lot of science that shows that, you know, athletes who will have an injury and they'll keep doing their whatever their practice is while they're on the sidelines, while they're on the bench, they actually continue to improve, even though they're not physically doing the exercise. Like, it's, that's just one example of all the different ways that we can kind of take advantage of things that we've created in our minds without ever stepping foot in reality yet.
Yeah. I wanted to wait. I want to get to the heart question too, and where you think the heart comes in. But I also, that answer made me go, huh, I wonder why, if this is why he thinks God exists. And we'll get to this because at least, at the very least, I was going to ask, why do you think then when people can vision, I guess I would say this is what's interesting to me. You know, there's a whole thing about you don't know what you don't know. So then I'm going, well, if I'm visioning something, how do I know that my idea, say I want to be a great singer, I start visioning what my life looks like, my relationships, my lifestyle, what I do every day, and all of a sudden I step into this and become better and see new opportunities. Is there an infinite intelligence then? I mean, what do you think, if people can do that without having experienced it, and we have a limitation of experiences in our waking reality, but somehow we're able to vision something that's not there. How are people then all of a sudden open to a new reality when they've never actually experienced it first?
Dude, I love this question so, so very much. You came to the right place, because I was, as a philosopher in college, this was like my number one favorite topic of study. And so there's this concept that I love to think about, which is non-local consciousness. Okay. And here's the long and the short of it. So there's this problem in philosophy where we don't actually understand what consciousness is. Okay. You know, we can point at it. We can kind of say like, oh yeah, I can see it in other people. Although we don't actually know, we're just pretending that you have consciousness or that I have consciousness. I can only know about my own consciousness basically, right? But there's this problem that we face as philosophers, which says, because we all want to say, well, yeah, humans are conscious, but rocks aren't, okay? But that leaves us with this difficult problem, because we want to say that like, well, yeah, at some level of complexity, matter, consciousness happens in matter, right? But that's that doesn't have a really clear answer, because we can say, well, at what level of complexity, and what about the level right below it? So, you know, is a cucumber conscious? Like, right. What about a sea cucumber? You know what I mean? And like, you can kind of keep going down the evolutionary trail until at some point you get to a place where you're like, I don't know. How do you determine which thing is conscious and which one's not? And because this is called the hard problem of consciousness, because we can't answer this, where does consciousness come from? It turns out a much easier answer to this problem is consciousness just is. It's just like gravity, strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force. Consciousness is just an inherent property of all matter. And when that matter happens to be organized like a human, it thinks like this. And when it happens to be organized like a dog, it thinks like that. And when it happens to be organized like a sea cucumber, it thinks like that. And when it happens to be organized like the ocean, it thinks like that. But now we can't imagine what that means. And, you know, like, we can't even imagine what it's like to be another person, but at least we can kind of create a visual in our mind, right? But like a bat, we can't even play that game, right? We can see that a bat is conscious, but we can't even imagine, because we don't have echolocation. We don't have the ability to use radar to find things in the world. So we can't even, like, we can kind of construct, you know, like Daredevil, the movie, you can kind of construct a semi pseudo visual of it, but who knows if that's right, right? And so, so there's this really interesting thing, because Alan Watts has a question. He says, I wonder what percentage of my body knows that it's Alan Watts.
I love Alan Watts. That's what I hadn't heard before. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a great quote.
Totally, right? It's a really interesting question, right? Because we tend to feel like our consciousness happens here, but for humans, like a big part of our sense data happens in the head. So it would make sense, right? And yet the whole thing is working together, being me, and I have sense data everywhere and all over the places. And if I really tune in, I can find it. And so, you know, combine these ideas together and you've got perhaps... It's a plausible telling of the story that consciousness is just a fundamental part of matter. And then matter and energy can neither be created nor destroyed, only change shapes. And so that very quickly gets us to there is one entity in the universe, and it constantly shifts forms and changes shape over eternity, right?
Yeah.
And so if I wanted to tell a story to prove God to myself, I would tell that one.
Right.
That there's just one entity eternally, constantly changing shape, playing a game. I don't know if this was Alan Watts as well, but playing a game of hide and seek with itself, you know, trying to pretend that there's not just one of us here.
Right.
So that we can have a conversation, because otherwise eternity, you know, would seemingly be quite boring.
yeah. I mean, I, you know what, I want you to reframe this for me. I don't know if you do this in the breakthrough session, but how is it not, I mean, I play these mind games all the time, Ben, because I read all the atheist books when I was in high school and in
me too
in college, and I never understood, I guess, what was the whole thing Richard Dawkins is talking about, and Daniel Dennett, I mean, they were talking about the way, just, it's like, how do we know consciousness for yourself, I guess? How do you know consciousness isn't just a series of neurons that just got smarter and more self-aware all of a sudden, and we're just, it's evolving? How do you know it's not just that? What makes you so confident that that there is this intelligence piece to it that exists outside of evolution?
Yeah. And the way that I answer that is, again, it goes back to that hard problem of consciousness. I don't think that it answers the hard problem of consciousness, because even if it just, some gene just got smart enough to kind of see itself and tell the story of itself or God, as it does in his book, that doesn't explain the part that got there. It doesn't answer the question of how could something be the kind of thing that could ever think.
Yeah,
that
I know,
could ever be aware, that could ever be conscious. Right. That's the problem that he doesn't address and that doesn't really get answered. And it's like a lot of the staunch atheists, they really like, they go for this, you know, and God, I mean, look, it's a big leap from what I'm describing to a traditional Christian notion of God, for instance, where there's someone who's making rules and like defining existence and judging people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those, and that's not the claim that I'm making, by the way. I'm making a claim that there is a thing that is all-knowing. Because if you take the sum total of all matter and energy in the world, right, in the universe, in existence, it's all knowing, because anything that's known is known by it. It's all powerful, because all power belongs to it. And it's all good, but it's also all evil. What they really don't tell you is you can't do evil to yourself, because there's only one of us here, right? So it's an eternal being that is, you know, spending time is all.
Yeah.
So, again, it doesn't get you to a Christian notion of like a God who sits up on high and judges. What it does do is it gets you to the essence of what most, any religion really, when they're talking about God, what they're usually talking about will fit these criteria, which is this combined total of all matter and energy in the world.
Yeah. Whoa. Okay. Yeah. Ben Easter explained God. Wow, that happened. It worked. It was pretty good. I was like, is that going to take a whole podcast? No, you did it. I mean, that's pretty interesting. So then let me take it back to this then. where do you think it is? Do you think the heart is an extension of this consciousness? I mean, is there a case where people are very much, I don't know, I've never really thought about this idea, the idea that someone could be so good at visioning their future and so powerful and really know the depths of, maybe Steve Jobs was like this to a certain extent, I don't know. People are so good at visioning and creating, but the heart piece isn't there. How many of those people are out there, do you think?
Well, what do you, when you say the heart piece isn't there, like, what are you meaning? The
I guess it's something that knowing it's people, I think a lot of people talk about this idea in spirituality that showing up as a, I guess the word is conscious, I don't know, showing up feeling like this is the right thing to be doing every day with your life, really knowing, I guess it's the gut too, but really like, I get to work with, I would think as a coach, when you get to work with people and you're sitting there with someone, it's not just your brain that's stimulated, though I know there's a part of it that it speaks to that intellectual, like, oh, human behavior and working with changing, that certainly lights me up. But I also think it's sitting there and going, wow, I feel empathy for this person and I feel their change in my heart. That wakes me up. This is the kind of work I want to continue doing. How valuable of a piece do you think that is for people? And how do you think it relates to having expanded consciousness?
That's a really interesting question. So usually the way that I address this kind of a question is my answer is values. Like what we're really talking about is alignment with what's most important to us in the world. And values are sort of these abstract concepts that we label, like, you know, I keep a deck of them next to my.
Oh, that's cool.
Let's see what the value for this. Inclusion is the value of the day.
Oh, so I love
when
it.
When we say that word, everybody in Pee Wee Herman's Playhouse will go, these sort of abstract qualities, like, you know, like my core values are connection, growth, and play. Probably authenticity is a really big one for me as well. It's one of the ones that gets included in my, and so when I'm talking about like doing what I'm meant to do, right? Which, you know, it's interesting because that kind of a question also like almost has a tint of the kind of God that sits up in heaven and judges. Like if there's no God, if there's no external thing that's determining what is like the right or wrong path or the plan that is happening in the world, what is meant to do mean?
That's
right?
A good point. Yeah.
You know, what does it even mean? But, you know, how we can interpret that and answer that question meaningfully for ourselves is what is important for me to do in the world? Like, look, I have, you know, however many years that I get as this entity in my life, what's the most meaningful way I can spend my time? What does it mean for me to experience what's most important to me in the world? And so for me, I would say, you know, I've done a lot of thinking about this. I think this is one of the exercises that a coach can bring you a person through is like to really explore what their personal values are and what their motivators are in the world. But, you know, like connection, I want to be having conversations with people. So I know that I'm having connection when I'm feeling it and like connecting to another person's mind and heart or whatever. Right. Growth. I want to feel like I'm meeting a challenge and like I'm having it, I'm experiencing it on this call. Right. Because you're asking me questions and then I'm like, trying to figure out how does my model address these questions, right? So I get to experience growth in that moment because that's how I experience growth is by meeting a challenge that I don't necessarily know how to get through yet, right?
You're doing great too. You're doing good too. You're doing great.
Thanks. Yes. I appreciate it. But play. I love play. Play is the thing that creates a safe space for me. It's the thing where like, you know, I don't have to have a right answer or you know, be looking out for like, difficulties because I can meet something and have joy in my heart as I sort of fail, you know, like, and this is how I think about learning things. Right. And authenticity of course is expressing what's true is a tricky word, but expressing what's real for me, what's like my most real. I love authenticity and author. They have the same root word, which is self. Yeah. Yeah. And so, so we're like, authenticity is like an expression of the self and author is like a being of the self. Right. And also, because authenticity is also like writing the self into being, which I think is really cool. But anyway, so so as I'm experiencing these things, this is my recipe for what, because somebody else could use these exact same words, but have a different meaning behind them, right? Play for some other person might be, you know, being silly and around, and that, and while I can respect and honor that, that's like not my version of what play is, right? For me, play is like a push and pull in a game like way where I have the safety to fail. And so I think coming to understand what are our individual, like, highest, most important things in our world, the things that without which life would be less meaningful. You know what I mean? And they're not things, you know, like they're not like, the example I always give to people is my motorcycle, because like my motorcycle is not a value, but it allows me to experience a value, which is freedom and excitement or exhilaration, right? I get to experience those like abstract qualities on my motorcycle, but the motorcycle itself is just a thing. So if you can touch it, it's not a value. If it can't exist anywhere in any situation, it's not a value. They have to be universal and they have to be available to anyone. So coming to really discover those things for ourselves, I think is some of the most important work that we can do, because like, you know, there's no magic ingredient. There's no like key to life, but if there were, understanding your values, your personal values, and then living every single moment in alignment with those values would get you a pretty far way along toward the combination lock of that.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're going to bring it all back with money. Curious what you think about this. Do you think, I've thought for a long time about, you know, the way the universe works and honoring the universe. And I've had a lot of, definitely in the past 5 or so years, actually, even with the coaching thing, there was a question where I was going, yeah, I think it could be good with this, but I might just want to be doing it for the money, which doesn't feel aligned. And now I'm in a position where I, you know, after studying more and more, and I'm going to start doing hypnosis again with people, because I do think there is a lot of value in it. And I love learning about it and sharing the experience with people. And I do think it's aligned with definitely what my curiosities and a lot of the other values that I have. I'm curious, do you think, what is the relationship between money and someone's values? And I guess my theory is, if everybody, I wonder if the universe aligns with people in the way that if you were living your values, that would be the most financially abundant you could be. If you were really aligned and you really got, you shown the light on what you're feeling inside and had a coach or just a roadmap to be able to go pursue that thing, that is your most, maybe not even financially abundant, but it would be enough to make your relationship to money good. I don't know if that's true, but I'm curious, where do you think the money and value piece line up?
Yeah, it's such a great question and something that I love thinking about so much, because money, it's such an important part of the way our society functions and the way that we like get around day to day. And because it's so important and because it's debt-based, I think is part of the challenge, which we can talk about in a minute, but the because those things happen in the world, it becomes so important that people think money is an end in and of itself. And we treat money as an end. So a lot of people, if you ask them what their goals for their life are, money will come in somewhere. I want to have X amount of money in my life, right? But that is a misapprehension of what a value is, because money is never, it's never been an end. It's always been a means of exchange of value. And so if that money is not being invested in something or spent on something, it's not actually doing anybody any good. In other words, it's like a stand-in value. It's like a thing that for people who don't actually haven't done the work to figure out what they would do with that money. You know what I mean? And in fact, one of the great questions that people can play along is, if you want to find out what's important to you in the world, ask yourself the question, what would I do if I never needed to work again? If I had more money than I could ever spend and I knew I couldn't fail? What would I do with my time? How would I spend my time, right? Because in some people, they'll have a hard time answering that question, because the first thing they'll think is like, well, I would, you know, like give it away to charity. I would give money away to charity. Or they'll say something like, you know, well, I would, you know, create some kind of like business. And it's like, okay, yes, great. And you never need money again. So how would you spend your time? Because this is a great way to get you to core values and what's most important to you in the world. This is something that's going to come out of that. Like me, I would have conversations with people. right? That's how I would spend all my time, is having conversations just like this, right, with people.
Yeah.
It's like one of my favorite things, right? I would go on hikes. I would do it on hikes. I would do it in various different venues while I'm like enjoying those things. But I would ultimately have some version of this all the time. And so the confusion of money as an end goal rather than as a means to an end is, it's confusing. It's like halting for, it tends to have this like halting effect on our dreams, because you're not actually going towards something that's meaningful to you. You're going towards something that you think is meaningful to you. And there's just not the kind of motivate. I mean, some people do have it. Some people are very money motivated. But for them, I think it's more, it tends to be more like a game. Like there's just like, you know, it's a financial scorecard that you can use to kind of track right. your progress in the game. And so to answer the question, I think values alignment is like really the end all be all. Like if we figure out our values alignment, then any amount of money would feel good. And if we don't figure out our values alignment, no amount of money would feel good, really. And that's just like kind of the way it goes. But as far as the energetics of money are concerned, you know, knowing your values and living in alignment with your values and doing what's important to you in the world doesn't necessarily make money for people.
Yeah. I was going to say, I know a lot of actors out there that went to school with me, and I was in that position for a while too, that, you know, it's still a hustle. I mean, so I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you have the miracle cure for being a successful actor living in alignment with your values, but then attracting money in the world. But I am curious what you think might get people on the right path.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because that's a good one. You know, one of my coach, Rich Lippman, actually says, he talks about this distinction, there being cash versus sex is the distinction. So there are times in our lives when we need money just to like pay the bills, do whatever the things are that like keep our lives functioning. And, you know, his opinion is that sometimes you just got to do whatever the hell you can do to make the cash, right? But sometimes you don't have a cash problem right now. You have cash, and that's when you can do the sexy thing. The thing that is like, the thing that drives you and like is like, you know, hallelujah. And if only you could do that thing for money, it'd be great, right? Sometimes you have to figure out how to make that work, and that takes some time.
Yeah.
So this is true with artists is a really great example, actors, things like that, musicians, right? Where there's money in it, and it's such an elite field by its very nature. You know what I mean? Just because of how many people are pursuing doctors, lawyers, you know, musicians, actors, like because of how many people are doing it, there's going to be, it's probably going to be a fewer percentage of people that make it through to the financial success place.
Yeah.
Right. And so you have to have the time to figure out how to do that. Now, that being said, there are ways to figure those things out in like non-conventional ways of, because, you know, there's a, like actors is a great example. You have a very traditional path to acting. Like you go out and you hit a lot of auditions and you do that. Or you look at someone like Harrison Ford. I was just reading his like origin story the other day, because
yes.
he was a carpenter before Star Wars, but he was an actor. He wasn't getting a lot of callbacks for auditions, but he had a friend who was a producer and worked with George Lucas. And that guy tried to pitch Harrison Ford to George Lucas, and it didn't really work. So instead he just coordinated so that Harrison Ford would be working on Doors while they were doing the auditions for Star Wars.
Right. Right.
And then they're like, hey, why don't you come try out for this Harrison or for this Han Solo role? And he came over and he did it. Right. So it's like a non-conventional path to success. Right. And I think that's something that is, there's a real opportunity in the world for anyone who wants anything in the world, is to like figure out what are those non-traditional paths, because on the traditional paths, it's just going to be lousy with other people. But if you can find the non-traditional paths, then you might find that, you know, you don't have less competition for these things that are really important. You can find your way in, but you still got to be able to do the work. Harrison Ford's a fantastic fucking actor, you know?
Yes. Yes.
Like he's really good at what he's doing. So, and he's gotten better over time, but still he could do the work. So that's like, you know, you got to be able to do the work.
Yeah, the non-conventional path. I think you're absolutely right. I think a lot of people, even in coaching and podcasting, in various, you see the rise of the brand, the rise of the unique niche, people coming up with a thing that is even more aligned. I mean, for so long, people were just calling themselves life coach, and now you have the branding coach, and you have this and this and the specific little, I mean, sometimes, yes, it's a way to just get the door in, and that's the same with acting. You're typing yourself to open the door, but I also think not everybody wanted to be Tony Robbins. People just wanted to focus in on this one specific thing, and it's more aligned, and people are more attracted to it. I think it's this opening yourself up. I actually think actors should brand themselves specifically. I think that would be,
and a lot of them do, right? Character actors, and
or even just think about branding even differently. I mean, this is one of the smartest things I ever saw. This was brilliant. This voiceover guy, that goes by the voiceover beard. He's on Facebook. He's on Instagram. He has a course where he teaches people to do this. His entire thing to break into the voiceover market, he said everybody's saying their first name, last name. He wasn't getting any work, but he had a beard. And he went, you know what? I bet if I just recorded videos from my under my nose down the beard and spoke into the mic and filmed that and just did funny videos and sent that to agents and called myself the voiceover beard, I'd break through the market. He got all this work. He's on Cameo. He now has a course where he teaches people to find their unique brand so they're not just another name. I think actors should do that. I think that kind of non-conventional thinking, that disruptive thinking, I know that's a word everybody throws around, disruptive, but I think it's very... that's the way the world works. People need to keep thinking, and maybe there'll be a period where people go back and being like, I almost think it might be funny to be like, I am the life coach again. Hey, remember when there used to be life coaches? Like, I am that. I'm just a normal life coach. That could be a thing for a while, and then people will disrupt that in cycles and cycles. I know I went into a rant there, but I'm curious, what do you think are some of the best ways that people can put on this hat of unconventional thinking so that they can actually move forward with something they love, but it might be saturated?
Totally. Well, I mean, it's such a good question. I think that it's really useful to look at what are your own strengths, right? Like that guy had a beard and he had already, like, some people can't grow a beard at all. They would have a hard time being the beard. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But looking at what is it that you're already really good at? What do you love to do? What are you, and you know, there's a lot of branding coaches that talk about this kind of thing. Like, what is your unique ability? But ultimately, like one of my unique abilities is talking to people, and I love connecting with people. And so, like, I tried to build a business like with social media and with an email list and all that shit initially. And it just, like, I couldn't get any traction that way. Not necessarily because it was saturated, although there's a lot of people doing that, right? But ultimately, like, it wasn't my voice. So when I started to have a conversation-based business where it was like one conversation at a time, and I just, all I got to do is find people to have conversations with and then ask those people to introduce me to other people to have conversations with. And as soon as I started doing that, my business blew up, and I've never had a problem with business since then, because I'm actually really good at having conversations with people. People like having conversations with me. Usually you're probably experiencing it right now. And then,
and then
you would be, if I were to say, hey, do you know anybody else who might like to have a conversation with me? Like, you could probably think of somebody right in your head. And so by playing that game and kind of asking those questions, I built a business, but it was because I found this thing that I was really good at. And then I just leaned into that to do the thing. And maybe that's writing for someone, and maybe it's having a beard, and maybe it's doing silly accents, and maybe it's, like, you know,
yeah,
like coming up with crazy concepts. Maybe it's coming up with infographics. Like, maybe it's whatever their thing is. You know, everybody has things that they've spent a lot of their time in their life practicing and developing. So why not start there? You know what I mean? Rather than trying to fit into some kind of mold or model that other people designed for you that you may or may not be mediocre at, you know, try to find the thing that you're, like, you really like a lot. Like, Jay Hendricks wrote a book called The Big Leap. Have you heard of it?
No, I've never, I know Jay, but I know some of his writings, but I've never read that one.
Well, anyway, The Big Leap is fantastic. And it's about finding your zone of genius, and not as opposed to your zone of excellence, which is where a lot of people get stuck because people are asking them to do the thing. They're really good at it, but it doesn't, like, light them up. It's not their, like, unique thing. So finding your zone of genius is what he recommends to really like live into this world. I think that's really valuable. Dan Sullivan talks about who, not how. So finding right. your unique ability and then enrolling other people to do the other stuff. So, you know, I think really like self-reflection is so important. Lucid shift, like shining a light on yourself to really figure out what is your thing. And then like, you know, courageously move toward that thing, the thing that you trust yourself to be able to do, that you're, you know, you're effortlessly good at, that sort of thing. I think it's like kind of a fun way to play.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, you know, I mean, everybody, if you want to continue having these conversations with Ben, everybody should go to lucidshiftcoaching.com. And one of the things you can do there is you can actually book a badass breakout session. I was going to ask you, is there overlap between zone of genius and finding your inner badass? And if not, what do you mean by finding this badass inside of you?
Yeah, I do think that is what it is. It's those areas where you're effortless. Man, there's the things that we do that it's like, it's just easy for us to do. And if we can figure out, the Japanese have this concept called ikigai, which is like figuring out the overlap of sort of the Venn diagram of like what you love to do, what you're really good at, what people need in the world and what they're willing to pay for. And where you find that overlap in the Venn diagram, you found like your hallelujah purpose, you know? And is that easy to do? You know, I don't know, maybe for some people they've already done a lot of the precursor work, but even if it's really challenging to do, isn't it worth it to do that kind of work? Like to figure out like,
yeah,
here are the things that I'm really good at that I really love to do. Like, how could I do those things in such a way that people would really appreciate it? And doing that work and asking yourself those questions, like, you know, I just think it's really valuable work. And everybody might not actually want to be an actor. It was just the thing that was presented to them. Like, I wanted to be an actor when I was a kid. Until I got into college and, you know, I went to FSU, they let in like 8 people into there. I was so proud to get in there. They only let 8 people in. And I literally was there for a week and a half. And I was like, oh my God, I cannot lie on stage. I cannot pretend to be anymore.
Like, that's very interesting.
Yeah. I refused to do it anymore. It just like wasn't real for me anymore. And I didn't want to do that game anymore. And so I dropped out and became a philosopher. Right. But listening to that, that was a scary thing to let go of for me because, you know, from the time I was 8, for a decade of my, then that was over half my life, right? I was telling myself a story that I wanted to be an actor. And so like to let go of that story, even though I was like ostensibly getting the good results in the world and, you know, I was getting called back and I was getting the parts, like it wasn't for me. And it took like a reevaluation of what was most important to me. And like, you know, I would say authenticity is the value that drove me to make that change, right? And so like becoming aware of my values was like a really important step that I'd only kind of dabbled in. I just knew like, this doesn't feel right for me anymore. This doesn't feel in alignment for who I want to be. And so I think we can all do that kind of exploration. And it's never done either. Like we can keep finding out new cool shit. That's awesome. We gave ourselves this gift of eternity, right?
Yeah. No, I think it's great. And I think it's, you know, it's a very, in a way you're reclaiming the word badass, which I think often has this negative, or not even negative, but it's just like, you know, this kind of like person that kills people is often, you could take a gun and you could kill people and shoot them down and look at that guy. Or yeah, no, this person is, I think there's often a, it's this sometimes assertive, but often aggressive. Like they're not afraid to go up in your face and be a badass. Do you know, do you have any people that come to you with that misconception? You're like, no. Here's what I mean by it.
Interesting. You know, it's funny because like most of the people who are drawn to me tend to be women in business. And I think that there's a different interpretation for women who use that term badass. And that's honestly, that was how I meant it in the first place, because I was doing market research and I knew that I wanted to work with these women in business. Cause for me, like a little sort of a side story, but I was raised by a single mom and I saw how powerful she was, but also how like she wasn't showing up as how powerful she really was in the world. And I was like, what the hell? My mom is so smart and so capable. And yet she like has these kind of these fears of going out and doing these things in the world. And I just think there's such power in our culture. Our society seems to very much value the masculine energy, like the expansive, the like goal achievement, the like vision, like all those things. But then the other side, this more what I would call feminine values of like connection and growing inward and sustainability and community like, we don't have a place for valuing those. And you can see this in like the way that we sort of treat stay-at-home parents, which is a very feminine role, whether it be a man or a woman staying at home, right? It's a very like sustainable family, right? And we don't find any value for that in the world. Like, oh, how long are you going to do that? And like, you know, it's like,
right. It's dismissed often.
Yeah. And so I, with my business, I really wanted to kind of go into this feminine values realm and see more of, again, whether men or women, I really want to see more of the feminine values held up as valuable in the world. And so I was talking to a lot of people like this, and they all happen to be women. And, you know, the word badass, the way that they were using it really meant like this kind of sort of defying the odds and like, you know, like playing like a bigger game for themselves. And
yeah,
just like had a cooler vibration than like the badass who like kills or slashes or stabs or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Wait, so then let me ask you this before, you know, now you brought up a new thing in my head, which is, do you think, how does that feminine energy meet the energy of the grind and hustle, making money you have to put? I know that's a tough question, right? Because or at least it's so societal. I mean, look, I personally don't believe that that's how you have to move through the world to make money, but I just know, having been in different roles before, different jobs, that there is very much like a, it's about the bottom line. You got to hustle, you got to drive, you got to willpower your way through things. And I think some people don't even think you can really, that place for connection is almost a tool used as part of the hustle rather than living in it and attracting a means to live and a means to thrive. You know, how do you balance those things? Or,
oh, man.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a big question.
I love this topic so much. So listen to what you just described too, because I want to relate them back to masculine and feminine. And again, I'm using masculine and feminine rather than male and female, because we all have both qualities, although I think archetypally the masculine is a male body and the feminine is a female body, because we can use the metaphors to explore the concepts, right? And so the masculine is, look at the anatomy. It's hard, it's driving, it's single focused, it's like singularly focused, right? That's like how a penis shows up in the world, right?
Right.
But the female genitalia, it's receptive, it's lubricating, it's receiving, right? It's soft. It's not single pointed. It's actually divided, right? And so it has connection built into itself, right? We have the single pointed focus of where all of our nerve endings happen, and their nerve endings are spread out all over the place. It's just like a full on pleasure center down there, right? And so I think this is like really a useful metaphor to think through what are the different, because it's two different kinds of values, right? But both are incredibly valuable to the world. And so the hustle grind, I think that's a very masculine form. Look, there's nothing wrong with it. I think we happen to be out of balance in our society. Like, we value the masculine, but we don't value the feminine. But it's a valuable thing, you know, to have something that's like kind of insensitive and driving and proceed, you know, that's very useful in something like, well, war, exploration, you know, that's sort of a kind of a realm, you know, logic and numbers, where you don't have, like, you don't want to get too bogged down by like feelings or confused by those sorts of things, but it's just not the only kind of value. And, you know, while Gary Vee is really big on the hustle, grind, you got to be working all day long. Look, Gary Vee wants to buy the New York Jets. I don't want to buy the New York Jets.
Right.
I'm perfectly happy having a nice, sustainable business in life, right? I don't want, you know, the saying, what is it? Don't live to work, work to live, right? I love that, right? I think of like this quintessential metaphor in my mind is like a garden. And like, I could take a garden, I could grow a garden and then collect all the seeds and then expand the garden and then collect all those seeds and then expand the garden. And it's like, pretty soon I'm going to be just gardening with all my life. And is that what I really want? I mean, the whole point of the garden was to feed me, my family, maybe my friends, you know, like,
yeah.
Did I really want to be a full-time gardener? Was that what I was out for in the beginning? And so I believe that there is a way to succeed in business that is not like a hustle, grind. Now, look, when you're starting a business, you're going to have to work. You have to build value streams. You have to like make the connections that you need. You have to get over the sales thing and you have to sell something that's valuable and you have to keep doing that for a while. But that's just like when you're putting in a garden, you have to, you know, hoe the row. You have to pull all the weeds out. You have to kind of prepare the soil, add whatever additives to it and then plant. But then once you do that, you go out and water and you weed a little bit every day and the garden will produce and keep producing for a long time. Right. And that's, to me, that's the essence of like what a feminine business is. It's like a sustainable business. It's like a business where, look, I don't want to grow anymore. I'm good exactly where I am. I just want to hang out where I am and keep doing what I do because I love it. And then go play, you know, spend time with my fiance, spend time with my puppy, you know?
Yeah. No, and I think you're right. And I think it feels different. I think that's why people are drawn to holistic practitioners. And you can tell the difference between somebody that is just, I mean, when you're talking about the coaches on social media, sometimes I wonder if these people even coach or if they are just marketers. Going, when's the last time you had a coaching session? Because I feel you are doing a lot of content right now, and I don't know how you have time. Maybe you talk to one person for, you know, 100K every year. But no, I mean, no, I think, and that feels very masculine. It feels very, versus, you know, the I think there is something that is, you know, I wouldn't call you, you know, I wouldn't. Well, first of all, you don't seem to like take feminine as an insult. I don't consider it an insult. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say you're just like completely floating around and just like, Greg, I feel you right now. I feel you, which is, again, a bastardization of that term. But still, you're still making change. You're still able to do it. You're still doing the breakthrough bar. You're setting up really cool infrastructure here. You know, you're helping people awaken their inner badass. And at the same time, I don't feel like you're pushing me to have to build your business life, like even the way with this conversation, the way we had to reschedule this podcast, I think it's proof that hey, you can show up in the world and you don't have to make it that hard on yourself.
I couldn't have said it better. Hallelujah. I'll go to that church all day, every day.
Yes. And you explained the female anatomy to me, which, and the male anatomy, which, you know what? I needed a re-education. That was important.
I like that metaphorical look at it. It's like one of my favorite interpretations.
It's good. It's good. Well, look, everybody, again, check out lucidshiftcoaching.com as well as, now look, you sent me, I mean, I can link people to this. Are we still, I don't know. It said it was an exclusive. I couldn't find it from the main page. So when you send me this link that I can use to promote, I was going, oh, is the breakthrough bar, is this like a special thing that not everybody gets to?
Yeah, no, the breakthrough bar is not. The breakthrough bar is built to be this container for us to show up and have this kind of conversation around growth and development. The other thing is the EFC, the Entrepreneurial Freedom Collective, and that is invite only. So don't even worry about that. We don't post that link. That's the thing.
Okay.
If people come to the breakthrough bar and we see the spark and we want them in the community, then that, you know, that'll be what that's for. But like for instance, having had this conversation with you, I can see a real value to having you in that community, right?
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So, and I look forward to continuing our conversation because I really have valued this conversation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody, Ben Easter, Lucid Shift Coaching. Ben, very enlightening. I appreciate the different perspectives you bring to all of this. I really thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been a fantastic conversation. This is the highest level of my life, right?
Definitely the highest level of my life. I love doing this show. I love having conversations like that. Thank you, Ben. Hey, I want to thank Ronnie McGilvery for the theme music. I want to thank you if you're listening to the end of this. Who listens to the end of podcasts after interviews? You know what? You're special. Make sure you follow me on Instagram at TheGregBornstein. Send your thoughts, send your feedback, send your hate. It's always great to have some haters too. That means you've really made it. All right, everybody. We'll talk soon. You feeling enlightened? You feel it. I know you do.